The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
Welcome to the debrief. We're going to take a look back on the week that was and also a little look ahead to the weekend. And this week I'm joined in the studio by Tabitha Monaghan, who's a political reporter with the Irish Independent. Terry Prone is here, chairman of the Communications Clinic, and Donico Bacon, professor of politics at DCU. And I'll tell you where I want to start now, the rent review, because from Monday, landlords will be permitted to increase the rent to market value when a tenant leaves the property voluntarily, or there'll be new properties this rule will apply to as well. So this is a big, big change. Mary Lou MacDonald in the Dáil says that this is going to be a bonanza for landlords. Tabitha, you might take us through where this might lead.
I think part of it is that we don't know where this is going to lead. I think we know, we've heard this week as well, it was Iris Wright, who's the biggest landlord in the country, saying that rent rules will boost landlords' income by 25%. So I think we know that that's where that's going to go, that the rents are going to increase. Though the government, any time a minister is out, is asked, how much are the rents going to go up by, etc. They won't talk about that. They'll talk about the security of tenure for the 6 years.
Yeah. Now, we had Pat Farrell on from the representative body that represents Iris Reid and others, and he said what they were referring to, he understands, is over the next 10 years. But even so, even Residential Tenancies Board says rents are going to go up as a result of this.
Yes, and what the government will say is that we need to increase supply. That is the core issue here, is that we don't have enough supply in the country. They're investing 9 billion euro in housing. We need an additional 20 billion. So the rest needs to come from the private sector. I can see that if it's going to increase by 25%, even over 10 years, I can see why that would attract investors. And that, I think, is the government's goal. But I think it's an incredible gamble, because what we're going to see is that in the short term, we are going to see rents go up significantly. It's not going to impact the security of tenure, for example, doesn't impact the current tenants at the moment. But we know that rent, the average tenancy is about 3.5 years. And if you take that into consideration, we're going to see turnover quite quickly. I think there's no doubt about it that you on this programme or myself are going to be covering people who have experienced rents increasing to these market rents, that if they're going back out on the market again, they're going to see huge jumps in their rent, or the expectation of that. But the problem is that the supply, that what the government is gambling on and what they're banking on, is supply. And that's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. It's not going to be within months. And again, the government cannot say, and they're asked time again, when will rents come down? When is supply going to come up? And they can't say. They can't determine that, because they're allowing the market to determine that instead. So I think they're going to come under an awful lot of political pressure in the next few months, because in the short term, renters are going to be hit incredibly hard.
Do you, Donica, agree that this is a bit of a gamble for the government to take?
It is a gamble. It seems a little bit of a matter of perspective. Certainly, the government are saying it's a half full situation, because they're emphasising the stability that will come to those who already have, a rental agreement. This is normal practice, by the way, in the continent. We are a bit of an outlier in that respect. In Germany, in the Netherlands, in Sweden, it's natural for people to be in long-term rental agreements, and they are usually open-ended. We could borrow some of that logic, I think. The half-empty part, which is the part the opposition, of course, are emphasising, is that for those who are entering new rental agreements, the market rate will apply, and that could be substantially more than what is being paid for now. Only time will tell. I'm not an economist. I'm not going to speculate which way it will go. But certainly there are two radically different perspectives on whether this will be a good thing.
You see the problem, though, in the work that you do, in that you're educating people who are having to commute to college to be there for their lectures, right? That is a new phenomenon in Ireland. I mean, part of being 17 or 18 was that you get to move out, go to college and have the crack.
Absolutely. That was certainly my experience. I remember my first week in college well, staying on a Friday evening for a debate between then, I remember, Danny Morrison and Austin Curry. We were so excited to see these. We're from the countryside. We never saw political figures up front. And then going to a concert the following day. I remember the Sugar Cubes, this obscure Icelandic band led by a person called Björk, who became much more famous later on. But that was all part of living
part of it,
close.
Of course.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
And now people are coming from as far away as Dundalk. I'm even hearing potential of Newry as a commuter town. Of course, from Virginia and Cavan and Meath. And that means that they're essentially just coming in for a lecture and then getting back on the train or the bus again. It's a very, very different experience. It's quite soulless, and college is so much more about the kind of formal tuition. There's other kinds of education about growing up, about becoming a person, and that's all about interaction and sociability and social life.
You're sitting beside someone who hated college, didn't you, Terry? Every
bit
of it.
The only dropout at this table, yes.
No, you're not. I dropped out of UCD.
You're kidding
yeah,
me.
Yeah, I did, yeah.
This boosts my confidence.
Well, I was doing the wrong course, but also I came from a very small school in Laois, and I went into this, you know, ginormous place with thousands of people, and I was only just gone 17, terrified. So it was all, there was a few things going on. I didn't hate it, but I was sort of overwhelmed by it, I would say.
Well, I wasn't,
just hated it.
I wish I could say I was overwhelmed, but I just simply hated it. And at the time, I was a student actress in the Abbey. And Joan O'Hara, wonderful actress, got pregnant. And suddenly I got a call saying, we're going on a tour to the West End of London. And you were the understudy in the Chocron. There was a wake and she was a singer and I could sing. And would I go, would I what? I would have taken their arm off at the wrist for it. And there was no way that I was going to stay in order to do exams that I was probably going to fail anyway. So I was out of there. And the sense of total freedom, except for one thing, Claire, we will not discuss my age, but it's extensive. I still have nightmares about UCD at the time.
And you've no regrets about not finishing what you went there to do?
Oh, God. I mean, when I listen to Tabitha, Tabitha is covered in degrees. She has two masters.
Have you?
I do.
I mean, I live with daily envy whenever I discover somebody like Tabitha. I would love to have letters after my name. My late husband said that I could share some of his letters because he
like
had
that,
loads
though,
of
it?
Degrees.
Doesn't work like
doesn't,
that. But no. There was a suggestion during the week that the college week be compressed so that people who are commuting wouldn't have to come in on so many days, which I found a bit sad, really, because I know if you're going in for one lecture, it's a bit of a pain, but you are supposed to be in the library or having a chat or, you know, spending a long time over a cup of coffee with your friends in college because you're going to be working and under pressure for long enough. You're nodding in agreement, Annika.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking of, I think it was Mark Twain. Everything seems to be attributed to Mark Twain or Winston Churchill, where he said, I never let schooling get in the way of my education. And, you know, it is all about the people that you meet. I'm still in touch with people I met in college. And you find your tribe. Because, again, if you're from, as I was, a small village in the countryside, you know, you have a kind of a random sample of the people. And you might have one soulmate in that village. But then you go to college and you have thousands of people who have come to college for the same reason that you've come to. And eventually you find your niche. And that's very important in affirming a sense of who you are at a very kind of pivotal point in your life. So, yeah, I mean, going back to that point about the availability of accommodation, it's part of the larger rental problem. And on-campus accommodation, which I benefited from in my first and second year, was also a great resource. So I didn't even have to travel very far.
Yeah,
to,
you were living
the
there.
I was living there. Mm-hmm. And again, it's an experience I would wish most people could go through.
Well, with a lot of experience in education, Tabitha, as we have learned from Terry, do you think that that's a good idea to compress the courses, condense them, rather?
I think if we're talking about it in terms of accommodation, I don't think it makes sense. I think if we're able to get enough accommodation that is close to a campus, then I think having the schedule spread out across the week doesn't actually matter, because if you're only 10, 15 minutes away from campus or even on campus, it doesn't matter. You can go for that coffee still and then pop home if you want to. What I found when I was doing arts, again in UCD, I was the same as you. I went in from a small school into UCD. Mm-hmm. I was doing history, and you go into Theatre L, as we were talking about, Donegal, before we came in. Huge course, 500 people in one lecture theatre. And I found that very overwhelming. Only because I liked the content of the course, I think, did I stick it out. But the problem for me was I was coming from the north side of Dublin, which at the best of times at rush hour was a 2-hour commute, and the public transport system was not good enough to get me over to UCD from there. So from a selfish point of view, I would have loved if I didn't have to go over for an hour in the middle of the day and then kind of hang around and figure out, did I want to go for the library or whatever. So I think from that point of view, but I don't think it's a solution to the accommodation
to the
issue.
Accommodation
if we're short of 38,000 student beds, that really should be the focus of the issue. If we're able to boost that and deal with the student accommodation problem, this becomes a non-issue, because you're closer to your course, you're closer to where you're learning, and then you can kind of pop in and out and this doesn't become a burden.
Did you see that story today about the University of Galway
yes.
thinking of getting rid of some of the arts courses because of a lack of interest.
I kind of, to a certain extent, I understand. And I know when, even when I was doing, I did my undergraduate, I started in 2013. And even at that stage, a lot of people would have considered arts their backup. Now, mm-hmm. it wasn't mine. And I really, I loved history, art history, all of that. And that's what I wanted to study. But I understood why, because there wasn't a direct route to the workplace. There wasn't a direct career line. And I think even now we talk about how people's milestones are being pushed out quite a lot. You know, they can't buy a home, so they're not getting married, they're not having children. I actually think part of that could be feeding into students' thinking, and that they just want to get going. They want to be able to get out of their parents' home. They want to be able to earn straight away.
Yeah.
They want a job. And look, hands up, like, you know, as a former art student, you don't get there straight away. Mm-hmm. And even you don't have that direct, OK, I'm going to go do
arts.
You have
to go on and do something else before you can get a job.
Everybody needs at least a master's now.
OK, listen, will we move on to Hillary Clinton? I want to talk about Hillary, and I want to talk about Bill, and I want to talk about Trump, because it's endlessly fascinating. What did you think of her going in there yesterday, making the statement as she did? I thought she was quite clever, Terry, in that she directed it all towards Donald Trump.
But it was also phenomenally clever in the overall management of the thing. What did we get last night? What have we got in this morning's papers? We have Hillary Clinton outside afterwards telling the story of how she was questioned. Now, that is not what you want if you are the questioner. You don't want your more idiotic questions about
UFOs
to be quoted mockingly by the person that you were supposed to terrorize. And it seems to me that they managed the staging of it phenomenally badly. They would have been better to look at any good Oireachtas committee here. The members all know that the framing of the question, the speech you make, the thing that you can then drop into your social media feed, that's where it is. Whereas they handed the initiative, the sense of shaping the story completely over to Hillary Clinton and allowed her to do a sort of Madonna reinvention. It was phenomenal.
Donica, what did you think? I mean, there's more to come today because we've got Bill going in there. That could be a different
That's
story.
That's true. Well, I mean, there is a certain theatrical aspect to this. I mean, they've always hated Hillary Clinton. Remember Lock Her Up? Mm. Slogan in the 2016 presidential election.
And him stalking her. Do you remember on that?
Yes.
And that debate.
You know, there was a real negative energy between Trump and Hillary Clinton, and coming from Donald Trump particularly. And that, I think, is being played out here. It is very partisan. I mean, it's essentially a Trump-dominated committee looking for Democrats. That's certainly how Hillary Clinton presented it. The fact that it's also behind closed doors, as has been said, you know, has a particular quality to it. Hillary wanted it in open because what it allows people to do is to leak. And then, of course, leaks lead to fuelings of conspiracy theories about what's not been getting out. And that's, of course, a negative aspect of American politics right now. So I think that in terms of what it means for Hillary Clinton, I think at worst it might, you know, cause some reputational damage, might, not for certain at all. But I don't think we're going to get to the heart of what it's supposed to be about, which is Epstein and the people who are being facilitated by Epstein. It's amazing that, you know, Peter Mandelson's been arrested. Andrew was taken in for questioning. Where are all the arrests in America? Where all this was taking place and originating?
Mm-hmm. And a whole slew of high profile resignations as well. I feel like I see one every single day since the files were released. It is an extraordinary story. It just does not stop giving, right?
No, it doesn't. But I think it goes back to, and it's kind of what Donica was saying, you know, we're moving further and further away, I think, from the victims of Jeffrey Epstein, who want justice, who want to see people, you know, held accountable for that. We're seeing it more so in the UK, for sure. But also, what did we learn from Hillary Clinton going to that? What did those who questioned her learn from it? You know, her opening statement: I do not recall ever encountering Mr. Epstein. I never flew on his plane or visited his island, home or offices. And then she said she described it as an incredibly unserious clown show of a deposition. Scathing. But what did we get from this?
Well, taking the narrative, as Terry says, I mean, that's the problem for the Republicans now. And then they have Robert Garcia, the Democrat, who is really driving this story around Donald Trump, is mentioned, but then you can't find the file relating to the mention because it's been redacted, and that's not going away either. Now, a quick word on what happened at the BAFTAs this week. That too is an extraordinary story. Donica, I might get your take on this one. This was about the Tourette's campaigner who made some comments which were picked up on a microphone. They were broadcast on the BBC. Questions being asked about the BBC, about BAFTA. One of their judging panel has resigned over these comments being broadcast. Isn't it funny, though, where the blame seems to be attributed? You know, I mean, people are saying it's unacceptable that this man said what he did. A lack of understanding around the fact that he cannot control what he says in a particular environment. Where do you think the blame, if any, lies?
I think if the blame lies somewhere, it is with the BBC, because the technology is there to prevent this type of thing from happening. Remember Eurovision? We had the phenomenon of where the booze when the Israeli performance was on stage were diluted and couldn't be heard, and they were being replaced by cheers. The technology is there, both AI, and sometimes you have a delay of a few seconds where you manually can edit out things. That's also there for many, many years.
But there was a gap, wasn't there, of 2 hours?
2 hours. Yes.
Well, that makes it even more surprising.
It's outrageous that the BBC allowed. It's as if they didn't register what had happened. Mm-hmm. And they had 2 hours in which they didn't even have to use an edit delay. They had the entire thing.
2 hours.
I think that this is astonishingly significant, Claire, because up to now, Tourette's has been, as far as mainstream media was concerned, kind of an amusing thing. Mm. Do you know, we had pet Tourette's people who were going to say funny things, but not dangerous things. In this instance, we have had it illustrated to us. Wait a second. This is a really serious disability. And there is, as you said, a lack of control. I was astonished to see on social media one commentator saying, oh, this wasn't just an accident. He chose to. No, he didn't choose to. That's the one thing.
This is John Davidson, the
Tourette's
campaigner, who was in this dreadful situation today. You know, I feel desperately sorry for him.
Yes.
Because he left early because he was so upset that it happened.
He went and sat in another room and had a screen in front of him to be able to watch the rest of the BAFTAs. And I think he was questioning himself, why was I sat so close to a mic? Like, really, they would have known that I had Tourette's, and that wouldn't have been an appropriate situation. But also, we know that there was other things that he said that were edited out and it was caught.
Oh.
So, and also, again, there was a director, Akinola Davies Jr. He had written a speech. He won, I think it might have been a new director. I can't remember exactly the category that he won in. But as part of his speech at the end, he said Free Palestine, and that was cut out. That was edited out by the BBC.
Right.
So there was they did have the ability to do that. As we said, they had 2 hours to do that. And it's another example of the BBC getting caught in another controversy and undermining its reputation and its credibility. It had the ability to do that. Blaming the people who were sitting outside in the TV van as well, I thought was a bit too much. Has nobody the cop on to call them up and say, hey, did you get that, by the way? You know, a little bit of collaboration and cooperation, I think, didn't go amiss here, or shouldn't have gone amiss here.
Sadly, that brings us to the end of our chat. Thank you so much for coming in, and thank you for listening, and indeed for sending on all of those messages in particular.
The Claire Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.